from the studios of the North Carolina Reading Service. It's the Indie Week, read by John Fetterson for our audience of blind and print-impaired folks. This issue, dated September 15, 2021. And by a happy accident, our music today happens to be provided by, I can't quite make out the company name through our vast studio windows, but it's an ice cream truck out in our parking lot, and it happens to be playing our wonderful theme music today. And I'm guessing that they will have sold out all their product today by the end of our broadcast, so let's just enjoy it for now. Well, this interesting development, a meta development, if you will, for Indie Week, in that most all of the news articles that would be labeled news of this issue is actually datelined today, the 16th, and it's available on the online indieweek.com and not in the print issue, which was printed on Wednesdays. So this is a Thursday in the studio. And so I'm going to be reading mostly the news articles from the IndieWeek.com, and most of the culture and things, except for one article, is in print. First, longtime Democratic lawmaker Verla Insko announces retirement plans. Coming off 12 terms in the State House, Democrat of Orange County yesterday announced plans to retire at the end of her term in December 2022. She's one of the longest-serving Democrats in the General Assembly, holding her seat for 24 years, as she put it, before the iPhone was invented. "It's just been an enormously gratifying career," she told her legislators on the House floor Wednesday. "I've been proud of actually being able to make a contribution to the difference that we make for people." Insko has long been a progressive political champion for the Orange County area. She served as county commissioner for 4 years and on the Chapel Hill Carborough City School Board of Education for 9 years before she was elected to the NC General Assembly in 1997. She's known for her work on health care, including on policies surrounding mental health issues and universal health care, as well as climate change, education, civil rights. In her retirement speech on the House floor, Insko highlighted the ongoing educational disparities that still persist in North Carolina public schools. During her time serving in the House, the chamber, as well as the state Senate, became controlled increasingly by Republican lawmakers, as she noted. She said, "Our differences are really important. I registered as a Republican. Both parties make mistakes. I thought the Republican Party had left me, and so I became a Democrat, but those things go back and forth. That may change someday and be just the opposite. So keep true to your values. We have our differences, but one thing we have in common is we have 80,000 people back home that are depending on us." Following the announcement, Chapel Hill Mayor Pam Hemminger praised her long service in a statement. "We're deeply grateful to Representative Insko for her dedicated service on behalf of our entire community and wish her well as she retires." And the Carborough Mayor also released a statement. Insko explained she was making her announcement early to give legislative hopefuls time to make a decision about running in 2022, ahead of the December filing deadline. She posted on her Facebook account she will, quote, "continue working to help elect more Democrats to the NC House, as well as to other state-level positions. With all things in politics," she wrote, "timing is everything." Next, datelined today, September 16th, the expanded federal child tax credit is helping families. Congress is debating its future, writes Lynn Bonner. Like millions of women, this story was originally published online at NC Policy Watch. Like millions of women, Sarah Anderson saw her income drop during the pandemic when her two part-time jobs ended and caring for her four children and supervising online school consumed her days. The federal child tax credit helped fill the gap left by that lost income. Parents started receiving monthly payments of $250 to $300 for each child on July 15th and will do so through December. They can claim the rest of their credits when they file their taxes next year. The enhanced credit is only for 2021, but there's a push by advocacy groups to make it permanent. Anderson used the first of the tax credit money to buy back-to-school clothes for her children, aged 10, 8, and 6. Anderson's youngest is 4 and on a preschool wait list. She said, "It kept our family afloat, honestly." Her husband works as an accountant. "It didn't replace my income, but it's been enough. I panicked on how to pay for back-to-school clothes." For this tax year, the American Rescue Plan increased that child tax credit from $2,000 to $3,000 for children aged 6 to 17, and from $2,000 to $3,600 for children younger than 6. Couples with a household income of less than $150,000 and heads of household with incomes less than $112,500 can claim the full amount. The credit begins to phase out for households with income above these thresholds and can be reduced by $50 for every $1,000 of income. But some of the households that need the money most might be missing out. The Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center said that parents of about 2.3 million children nationwide may not receive the payments because they earned too little in 2019 and 2020 to file tax returns. Its analysis shows parents of about 50,000 North Carolina children might not be receiving the credit. The households are spread throughout the state, but more than 500 are in Wake Forest. State Representative Terrence Everett, a Democrat whose district includes Wake Forest, said he had not heard of residents of his district not receiving payments, but would look into it further. He said families are entitled to those tax credits and should be getting them, especially if they are in desperate need. Quote, "I find it concerning and something we're going to have to follow up on with these communities," unquote. Millicent Rogers has used the monthly payment for COVID-related costs for her 10-year-old son, who fears becoming infected. The son has severe allergies that cause his nose to bleed when he's outside in the heat. The blood gets on his masks, which require frequent washing. The tax credit payments have helped Rogers purchase good-fitting, high-quality, disposable, and reusable masks, as well as paying to do extra laundry at her apartment complex and buying more food so her son can bring his lunch to school and avoid the cafeteria line. Then there's the extra money needed for gas so she can take her son to after-school care because of driver shortages. Bus routes are limited. Advocacy groups say the increased credit and the provision making it fully refundable means that parents who don't owe taxes qualify, and that has had an outsized impact on Black and Latinx children. Eric Rodriguez, Senior Vice President of Unidos U.S., said in a news conference last week, "The tax credit is enormously powerful. It's already having important anti-poverty effects on communities, and particularly children of color. One of the biggest and most significant changes that we saw from the previous round of stimulus was making it fully refundable so that more Latino and African American children could receive the credit than ever before. Before it was fully refundable, one in three children did not receive the full amount or any at all because their parents made too little money to owe taxes," according to the Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia University. "They were disproportionately children of color, children of single parents, and those living in rural areas," according to the findings. 70% of households headed by single women did not receive the full credit. Unidos U.S., Color of Change, and the Economic Security Project Action support making this year's child tax credit changes permanent and extending it to include immigrant children with individual taxpayer identification numbers. The groups wrote a letter to Congress endorsing permanency, signed by about 50 organizations, and that letter said, quote, "There is no better investment Congress can make than in our nation's children. It will pay back in the short term when parents inject these payments back into local economies. And in the long run, the data are clear that lifting a child out of poverty leads to better nutrition, better test scores, and higher rates of school enrollment and college entry." The United States House Ways and Means Committee last week proposed extending the enhanced refundable child credit until 2025, reported the Washington Post. And that extension is part of the $3.5 trillion economic package Democrats are crafting. U.S. Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, suggested last weekend that parents should be required to work or go to school to get the credit, saying during a CNN appearance, "Don't you think if we're going to help the children that people should make some effort?" The Biden administration pitched the credit as a way to significantly decrease child poverty, and early research has shown such a reduction. Adults in households with children saw a 3 percentage point decline in food insufficiency in surveys after the first child tax credit payment landed in bank accounts, according to the Census Bureau. The survey also showed a decline in households that had trouble paying weekly expenses. And the Census Bureau said food insufficiency in households with no children was about the same before and after that payment. The Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia University found that the July payment kept 3 million children out of poverty that month, while the child poverty rate fell from 15.8% in June to 11.9%. Anderson, who lives in Durham, is a former kindergarten, middle school, and special education teacher. She left the classroom after the birth of her second child. The cost of child care was greater than her salary, and returning to work didn't make economic sense, she said. The pandemic has taken a lot out of parents, she said, and it's helped to have extra money to cover basic needs. She said, it's not so much money that anyone's going to get rich off it, just to have a little more flexibility and have a little bit more stress taken off and not worry. When her youngest child starts school, she's considering returning to work as a substitute teacher, so her schedule will match her children's schedule. It's tricky finding childcare in the pandemic, she said. She's also hoping Congress will keep the enhanced tax credit, though she's not counting on it. She said, I don't get my hopes up that our government will do the right thing for women or families or children. From Durham, Tomasi McDonald's column, a trio of champions will spend the weekend guiding young black men in Durham towards success. Duke University graduate Derek Rhodes was interning at the Public Affairs Office of the U.S. Department of Justice when he heard that self-appointed vigilante George Zimmerman was acquitted in the shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Excuse me. It was the summer of 2013. Rhodes grew up in Durham. He was a junior at Duke University and manager of Duke's men's basketball team that won the NCAA championship in 2015. And he says, I was shocked. He said their birthdays were a couple days apart. The hoodie that the teen had worn when he was shot dead was similar to the ones Rhodes liked to wear. The newly minted college graduate thought a guilty verdict was forthcoming. Instead, he adds, the acquittal left me in a daze about my own life. On that day, a seed was planted inside of Rhodes' mind, heart, and spirit. The seed took root, and on Saturday, the Durham Success Summit, founded by Rhodes in 2018, will host its fourth annual event at the W.G. Pearson Center, quote, to uplift and empower young black college-aged men between ages 18 and 24 to take the critical first steps in their unique paths to success. And that's according to a DSS press release. The summit began last night with a reception. Saturday's workshops will kick off with a keynote speech by Reggie Love, a former political aide and, quote, body man to President Barack Obama. Love also has Duke roots. He was a two-sport athlete, playing wide receiver in football and a walk-on with the basketball team, and the team's captain his senior year, in 2001, when the Devils won the NCAA Finals. DSS board member Nolan Smith also has Duke roots. He, along with Rhodes, was a member of the 2010 NCAA Championship team. Rhodes jokes that the event will feature a trio of Duke champions. After a professional career that includes stints with Google, the NBA's Miami Heat, and Microsoft, Rhodes founded DSS with the aim of shepherding community awareness, career and leadership development, networking, and mentorship opportunities for young, college-minded men of color. And he says, I was at a turning point in my life. I was tired of seeing men like me being treated as if our lives didn't matter. Now, 3 years later, I'm happy to have created an event that uplifts and supports young black men. I wanted to prove that with the right tools and the right people, historically excluded communities can have their untapped potential unleashed, benefiting families, businesses, and the local region's economic status. According to the DSS website, the nonprofit has served more than 150 young men of color and partnered with 50 speakers, mentors, and coaches, plus 10 community partners, including NC Central University. One DSS participant, Caleb Vandenberg, graduated from Elon University with a public health degree in May. Vandenberg, 22, grew up in Durham. He now works as a program coordinator with the nonprofit and teaches science and coaches basketball at the Burlington School in Alamance County. Vandenberg first became aware of DSS 2 years ago when he and his friends attended a community pop-up talk. And he says, Rhodes and other community leaders ran the talks and listened to the young attendees concerns. We were going so much that Rhodes took notice. We were coming every week. Vandenberg says DSS interacts with 15 to 30 young black men each day and has had a huge impact. DSS is like an outlet for so many black men in our community, he says. It gives us chances to give back to our community. Another DSS alum turned program coordinator, Xavier Nunez, is working for Visa in San Francisco. Nunez grew up in Durham and graduated from UNC Chapel Hill in May. He says he's known Rhodes for nearly a decade and, quote, knew he had the potential to bring great things to the community. He became involved with DSS last summer. Nunez explains he was sort of the only one doing things in the community in person. He was like a breath of fresh air for me because I was interning at Amazon inside all day looking at spreadsheets. Prior to graduating, Nunez said he helped organize DSS college tours for high school students at NC Central and Duke universities. The nonprofit also hosted fun events, renting out a movie theater to watch the premiere of Space Jam 2, an NBA Finals watch party attending a Durham Bulls game, and a late summer golf outing in Pinehurst. And he says, I still help out as much as I can. I'm coming back for the big event this weekend. Rhodes says the summit in South Durham's historically black Haiti district is taking place at a much-needed time. He says only one-third of the Bull City's black residents have a bachelor's degree or higher, compared to more than 60% of the city's white residents. That's significant in a high-tech region where a college degree often translates into a living wage and an enhanced quality of life. The DSS website notes that over the decades, black men have struggled to achieve equal opportunities, particularly in the workforce. Here in Durham, even though black men and boys account for 38% of the city's population, quote, they have been historically excluded from contributing to the economic future of our city. Rhodes knows about being excluded. While growing up in Durham, he didn't step foot on Duke's campus until he was a student. That seed that was planted inside him after Trayvon's murder began to germinate when he looked at the communities and neighborhoods where he grew up. He wondered what might be going on with the young men who lived there. He says, Durham was changing and growing in a crazy way. I honestly felt like there was a kind of once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to not leave folks on the outskirts. For the past 3 years, the summer was a day-long event in the city's most impoverished neighborhoods. But the event gained traction as a back-to-school affair where, along with lunch and student giveaways, professional mentors offered to read the older students' college and course essays. In 2019, just before the pandemic, Rhodes partnered with the NC Central's African American Male Initiative. Roderick Heath, director of that initiative, told Indy that the DSS mission is not unlike the charge given to college students enrolled in his program. Return to your communities and help other men like yourself. And he says, Rhodes is very ambitious. He goes out into the community to see those young men. He shows up. I knew this was an organization I needed to be connected with. I told him, I'll do the higher ed portion. You bring the community to higher ed. Rhodes was working as chief of staff at Microsoft for a little over a year in April when he decided to resign. He was on edge again, this time working in Seattle while awaiting a jury verdict for Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer convicted of murder in the shooting death of George Floyd. And after wrestling with whether he should leave what he describes as a dream role with Microsoft, he decided to return home and mentor young black men in his hometown. He flew home in May on Mother's Day with his mother, Carolyn Rhodes, a longtime social justice activist and diversity consultant who works on behalf of senior citizens. Carolyn Rhodes was in Seattle for a 30-day visit with her son. And she told the Indy, when he told me I resigned to work full-time with DSS, I said, you found your purpose. It was almost like a calling since he was a boy growing up and coming into his own. Rhodes says, I knew I wouldn't be of value to Microsoft if my heart wanted to do something bigger and better with the world. Now to Jordan Wilkie's story in the online IndieWeek.com. It's originally published at the Carolina Public Press. Back to the drawing board, an FAQ on redistricting in 2021. Every state in the country is redrawing political maps based on new data from the 2020 census, and many eyes across the nation are focused on North Carolina. The Tar Heel State has been a hot spot for legal fights over political maps since the 1990s, battles that have accelerated since 2011, when Republicans took control of the state legislature and used that newfound power to draw new political maps from the 2010 census in their own favor. Unlike previous gerrymandering efforts, maps drawn over the last decade applied sophisticated software to narrowly tailor districts to give the maximum advantage to the party in power. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled these maps were unconstitutional because they racially gerrymandered, meaning the maps were drawn in a way to give black people less political power. The legislature, overseen by federal courts, redrew those maps in 2016, but those again faced a legal challenge. In 2019, state courts ruled those maps to be unlawful, hyper-partisan political gerrymanders under the state constitution, and forced the legislature to try yet again for the 2020 elections. The legislature will follow the same rules for transparency in this year's redistricting process that the state courts required in the last round of redrawing. Redistricting will dominate the news and discourse for months to come. In this fact, we cover the basics you need to know to follow along and participate in the process. What is redistricting? It's the process of redrawing political maps based on the census data collected every 10 years by the federal government. The Census Bureau decides how many United States House of Representatives seats each state will have based on its population, an idea called apportionment that is required by the U.S. Constitution. State legislatures then take that data from the Census Bureau and use it to recalibrate political boundaries so that roughly every person in the United States has the same amount of political power in the U.S. House of Representatives. State legislatures use the same concept to draw political boundaries within the state, too, so that each state House district holds the same number of people, and each Senate district does the same. Redistricting can also occur in between census if ordered by the courts, but they must still base their new maps on the most recent census. This kind of political divvying up can extend to the local level. Local governments, including school boards, city or county commissioners, can be elected by district or at large. If it's by district, those districts need to be modified every 10 years to adjust for population change. At large elections don't require districts because every voter in an area, for example, a county, gets to vote in that election. Some North Carolina local governments have representation districts in which a candidate for office must live but will be elected at large. Depending on the local rules, these districts may also need to be drawn according to population initially or following an annexation, and may also need to be updated after each census. Why is redistricting so contentious? In a cynic's view, redistricting is an opportunity for legislators to pick the people who elect them. For people or political parties trying to stay in power, this is helpful. For people or political parties with fewer seats in the state legislature, redistricting is seen as potentially dangerous, as unfavorable maps could lock them out of power for another 10 years. Politicians and political parties want maps where likely Democratic or Republican voters are divided up in ways to give themselves or their parties a better chance at winning elections. When will redistricting start? It's already begun. The census released the data that legislators need to redistrict on August the 12th. The joint NC House and Senate committees on redistricting met and set guidelines for the rules they would use to draw the maps. Legislative staffs are working on taking the data from the census and putting it into a format that legislators and the public can use to draw maps. Legislators expect that data to be available in early September. Well, is it? When will it be over? The pandemic delayed the collection and release of census data by 5 months because the legislature did not also try to decide to delay the 2022 election. This has created a truncated timeline for finishing redistricting. The NC State Board of Elections, which is tasked with running elections using the maps that the legislature creates, says it needs maps no later than the end of next month, October, to be ready in time for the December candidate filing deadline. The legislature will likely respect that deadline with a week or two of latitude. If anybody doesn't like the maps and sues, redistricting could go on for years. State courts forced the North Carolina legislature to redraw maps in 2019, showing that the fight over maps could drag on until the next round of maps is drawn from the 2030 census. What are North Carolina's rules for redistricting? The legislature adopted its map drawing rules in August 12th. The legislature will not use either racial data or political data in drawing its maps. In 2016 and 19, federal and state courts respectively dismissed North Carolina's maps for racial and overly political gerrymandering. Legislature will also attempt to follow county boundaries with some relatively minor exceptions. That will prevent oddly shaped districts like the famous District 12, which for years looked like tributaries in a river flowing through black communities across six counties, from the Y shape that connected Guilford and Forsyth down to Mecklenburg. What if I want to draw a map? You can. The legislature operates public redistricting terminals that anyone can sign up to use. All the maps either the public or legislators create on the terminal will be part of the public record. You can also draw maps at home using websites like Dave's Redistricting or District R. You can even share your thoughts about the maps you've drawn with the legislature. If you're interested in participating in the process, the nonprofit and nonpartisan NC Counts Coalition created a resource-rich guide to learn about redistricting and to share public comments with the legislature. And all of these things I've just read to you, many of these are links on the IndyWeek.com, where you can go to these places, and I encourage you to look there or investigate there to see about these resource guides and sharing thoughts. What if the maps legislators draw are unfair? If you're a North Carolina voter, you can probably file a lawsuit, but legal challenges are very expensive. Some people who object to maps connect with an advocacy group that shares their interest. If you think the maps are unfair, lots of big interest groups likely do too. Should we expect lawsuits? Yes. Redistricting is controlled by the legislature, and that's been controlled by Republicans since 2010. Several rounds of lawsuits over redistricting have come from left-leaning and Democratic groups. Eric Holder, the former U.S. Attorney General under Barack Obama, is now the head of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. He signals back in February that the group is keeping a close eye on North Carolina. Over the last decade, North Carolina's League of Women Voters, Common Cause, and the state chapter of the NAACP have sued North Carolina over the maps the legislature drew in 2011, then again in 2016, after federal courts forced them to try again. In North Carolina, the governor does not have any say over political maps, meaning that the courts can provide the only check on the legislature's map making. From Raleigh now, by Jill Killian, originally published on NC Policy Watch. Faculty members at North Carolina State University are calling for a vaccine mandate for all students, faculty, and staff with on-campus responsibilities. The school's faculty senate passed a resolution calling for that mandate late Tuesday. The resolution cites the Food and Drug Administration's full approval for Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine last month and the university's, quote, responsibility to provide for the health and safety of its students, faculty, and staff, unquote. NC State is the largest campus in the UNC system with nearly 37,000 students, more than 2,400 faculty, and more than 7,200 staff. Last month, six former state health directors asked the UNC system to mandate vaccinations at all system universities. Students and faculty groups across the system have expressed their desire for a mandate, as have many chancellors. UNC system President Peter Hance and the UNC Board of Governors have not yet been willing to go that far. In a message to chancellors last month, Hance said campuses should require students to submit to re-entry testing, provide proof of vaccination, or if unvaccinated, undergo weekly testing at a minimum. Chancellors should also have a get vaccinated or get tested regularly measure in place for faculty and staff, Hance wrote. And he said, vaccination is our best weapon against the virus. Vaccines are safe, free, and highly effective against all known variants. Since the vaccine became available last spring, you have made extraordinary efforts to vaccinate both your campus communities and the general public, administering more than 92,000 vaccinations at clinics across the state. We will continue to offer free, life-saving vaccines to students, faculty, and staff on campus, and we will continue to encourage and incentivize every eligible person to get vaccinated as soon as possible. Hance has consistently said only the North Carolina Commission for Public Health can mandate vaccines at the university level, and the UNC system office and chancellors at individual schools have for months been citing that rule as an impediment to a vaccine mandate. Hance's legal analysis, however, has been questioned by some, who cite, among other things, the fact that UNC schools required a measles booster during the 1989 outbreak of that disease. The Commission for Public Health is a 13-member body. Under state law, four members are elected by the North Carolina Medical Society and nine are appointed by the governor. In the highly politicized environment around vaccine and masking mandates, however, the commission has not yet taken any public action on a mandate and is not scheduled to even meet again until October 15th. The members of the UNC Board of Governors are political appointees. The board is heavily conservative, with just one registered Democrat currently on the board. But the issue of mandating or even encouraging vaccination is divisive even within GOP circles. In a video that made the rounds online last month, Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson told a crowd at a conservative event, it's not the job of elected officials to encourage people to take a vaccine. Robinson, a Republican, said those doing so should be voted out of office. The most powerful elected GOP leaders in the state, NC House Speaker Tim Moore, Republican of Cleveland, and Senate President Phil Berger of Rockingham, are among the prominent Republicans in North Carolina who have encouraged vaccination as the best method of beating COVID-19. The number of students, faculty, and staff who are actually vaccinated at each UNC system campus is not clear. UNC schools are asking students, faculty, and staff to attest to their status, but students are not required to provide actual evidence of their vaccination. As of Monday, North Carolina State said 73% of community members, that's about 33,000 people, including students, staff, and faculty, had either uploaded vaccine records to the school's Healthy Pack portal or been fully vaccinated on campus. As of Wednesday, the school's COVID dashboard showed 510 positive cases on campus since August 1, determined either through on-campus testing or self-reporting. Of these cases, 422 are students and 88 are employees. The UNC Board of Governors will hold committee meetings Wednesday and a full board meeting on Thursday. I guess that's today. They are expected to discuss the ongoing question of vaccination at campuses. And now, yet by Greg Childress, another originally published in NC Policy Watch article, Cawthorn conservatives urged Johnston County School Board to end a mask mandate. Representative, U.S. Representative Madison Cawthorn was more than 300 miles from his congressional district on Tuesday, arriving in Smithfield to ostensibly speak against the school district's mask mandate. Opponents and supporters of the mask mandate began to gather on the lawn outside the Johnston County Public School Administration Building in Smithfield, hours in advance of a scheduled rally. But the Johnston County School Board meeting quickly took on the tone of a political rally rather than a mask protest after Cawthorn, a Republican congressman from Hendersonville, arrived. He said, explaining his visit, "The people in my district want this state to stay red. We have a very strong General Assembly, and I think we need to be mobilized all over the state, conservatives going on offense to make sure we get a good governor in the next election in 2024. Chris Cooper, a distinguished professor of political science at Western Carolina University, offered this assessment of Cawthorn's visit in a column posted in Old North State Politics. Quote, "Cawthorn's trip to Johnston County has been covered in media outlets across the state and has spawned enough Twitter traffic to rival an early season Duke-UNC game. The attention is the point, and it's working. If the attention is both the means and the primary end, then fundraising is a secondary goal and one that will likely be successful. Cawthorn raised over $1.7 million through June 30th of this year, a sum that dwarfs the receipts from established Republican members of Congress like Patrick McHenry and Virginia Fox." Cawthorn was the guest of Citizen Advocates for Accountable Governments, CAAG, and the JCPS Parents for Freedom. And Dale Lands, co-founder of CAAG, said, quote, "This is about good and evil, beating the evil at whatever cost there is, beating these mask mandates, beating the numerous attacks on our personal freedoms. These are the things we have to fight for." State and local Republican candidates each grabbed the microphone to weigh in on the district's mask mandate, their views on government overreach, and the GOP's wedge issue du jour, critical race theory. And Sandy Smith, a Republican who lost a 2020 congressional bid in North Carolina's 1st District to Democrat G.K. Butterfield, said, "I know we've got a lot of moms and dads at work, but thank you for coming out to support our mama bears, our children, and our teachers who do not want to teach CRT." Educators have consistently said that CRT, an obscure academic subject that examines how racism shaped American law and public policy, is not taught in K-12 schools. Although outnumbered, a handful of parents resisted mask opponents. Alan Hall, a JCPS parent, said, "I feel like this whole thing is a circus. We're here to talk about things affecting our schools other than masks. I think we should all be coming together as a community to talk about why our schools are underfunded, why we do not have teaching assistants, why are we missing school bus drivers, things that are important." He directed some of his anger at Johnston County commissioners for inadequately funding the school system. He says, "The answer to why they're not funding our schools is because they feel like we're teaching CRT in our schools. I feel like our old, completely white Board of Commissioners is scared of black history. They're scared of offending white people. Those are their constituents, the one who voted them in." Stephanie Edmonds says she's homeschooling her 3 elementary school-age children because of the mandate. She says, if we lose our ability to choose what goes in our body and on our body, there's no freedom beyond that. Edmund said her terminally ill child could die from the flu, but claimed doctors have never told her to mask the child or wear a mask when around her. So now I'm supposed to say the science is settled? She asked. When was it settled? On Tuesday, the JCPS board took no action on the mask mandate, opting to postpone it due to the absence of Vice Chairwoman Terry Sessoms, whose husband recently died. A special virtual meeting has been scheduled for 2 p.m. Monday to address the mask mandate. A new law requires school boards to vote on the masking policies monthly. Cawthorn has traveled the state in recent months to attend such meetings as a way to energize the GOP conservative base. He's also promised to save his generation, he's 26, from socialism and to protect parents from government overreach, including masking and vaccination requirements. It's time to be fearless, he said. It's time to stand up to Roy Cooper and say that the family and individual freedom always comes for the government. The congressman's remarks about Cooper are odd. The governor has allowed individual school districts to decide whether to require masks. Most of the state's 115 districts now require them. After initially making masks optional, several districts changed course amid surging COVID infections and hospitalizations. School leaders were concerned that outbreaks would force their districts to return to remote learning. Cawthorn argued that Democrats have used the pandemic to chip away at basic freedoms, and he said, if we continue to allow them to have incremental victories over our liberties and our parental rights and our rights as Americans, where they take inch after inch, year after year, that's how we get to the point we're at now. The congressman was joined Tuesday by Robbie Starbuck, a Tennessee congressional candidate, and Beau Hines, a candidate for North Carolina's 13th congressional district, which includes 9 counties in west central North Carolina, as well as other candidates vying for seats in local races. Hines says the message he's receiving from voters is they want governments to, quote, stay out of their lives. He said, we're losing the culture war. We have rampant illegal immigration. They're watching our rights be stripped away right before our eyes. This ends in 2022. This ends today. Starbuck, who is of Cuban descent, said his family has experienced the shortcoming of socialism. He pleaded with supporters to fight against tyrannical school boards run by Marxists who are trying to indoctrinate our kids to hate our country and hate what it stands for. Are we going to allow you parental rights to be stripped from you? He asked. Cawthorn's visit comes as the school district's COVID dashboard shows 178 active cases and 782 quarantines among children, students. Meanwhile, there are 15 cases and 50 quarantines among staff. In mid-July, with infections and hospitalizations declining, Rodney McCaskill, the chief medical officer at Johnston Health, said of health officials, quote, thought we were getting to the end of this. But last night, McCaskill told the board there's been a tenfold increase in the number of patients in the county's lives on the county's hospitals who are on life support. Greg Childress, now from a September 14th dateline. Originally published at NC Policy Watch, U.S. Department of Education approves spending plan for COVID relief money. The Department of Education has approved the state's spending plan for $1.2 billion in aid from the American Rescue Plan Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief, that's the ARP-ESSER, fund. The money is the second installment of $3.6 billion awarded to North Carolina to help K-12 students recover from pandemic-related disruptions and to improve academic outcomes. The state received the first $2.4 billion in March and will use the award to launch evidence-based initiatives, in quotes, to support schools statewide, including $30 million for high-impact tutoring, $19 million for a competency-based assessment and platform, and $35 million for competitive grant programs for summer school and after-school extensions, according to an NC Department of Public Instruction news release. State Superintendent Catherine Truitt says, North Carolina's plan for this funding isn't just about recovering from the pandemic. It's about rebuilding and re-envisioning the education landscape in our state. Districts and schools are receiving 90% of the state's total $3.6 billion allocation, based on the same proportion used for allocating federal Title I funds keyed to census poverty estimates. The remaining 10%, or $360 million, will support statewide initiatives to help schools and students recover from pandemic-related disruptions and to also improve outcomes long-term. Here are the highlights of North Carolina's spending plan. The total allocation, $3.6 billion. And the top priorities within North Carolina's plan, academic recovery in reading and math, and I will just parenthesize that the latest very expected totals from these studies, evaluative studies for reading and math, showed declines over the COVID period. So academic recovery and addressing the social, emotional health and well-being of children throughout the state. And the highlights of North Carolina's plan. Return to in-person learning in 2021. Public schools are required to offer in-person learning for the 21-22 school year. Addressing the academic impact of lost instructional time. The Department of Public Instruction will consider specific evidence-based interventions, including $30 million for high-impact tutoring statewide, $19 million for competency-based assessment and platform to be used across the state, and $35 million for a competitive grant program for school extensions. Next, investing in expanded after-school programs. Department of Public Instruction has proposed allocating ARP-ESSER funds to support extended learning recovery, after-school enrichment. Staffing to support students' needs. The Office of Learning Recovery and Acceleration is working with healthcare professionals to improve health and educational outcomes for children in North Carolina. The team is currently working to expand an existing model that provides elementary schools with access to pediatricians via telehealth technology. Early indications show this telehealth option reduces barriers to care for students, resulting in improved health outcomes for children, reduced chronic absenteeism, and a decrease in the impact of health care-related costs on parents or caregivers. Next, community engagement and consultation. Department of Public Instruction held stakeholder engagement sessions in July and August of this year, and the Department of Public Instruction received formal approval from the State Board of Education to create an ARP-ESSER advisory group. This advisory group will convene regularly and provide suggestions to improve implementation and further development of the ARP-ESSER state plan. All right, I'm sure I have time at least for this article, more culturally based, and it's from a book section, and it's written by Fred Wasser, and it concerns Walter Bennett's second novel called The Last First Kiss, and that was published, released on September 14th, just yesterday. Fred Wasser wrote this article. A vacation home on the North Carolina coast is the setting for Walter Bennett's contemplative second work, The Last First Kiss. The novel's protagonist, Ace Sinclair, is in his mid-70s and retired from law practice in Raleigh. His wife died about 10 years ago. As the book begins, Ace and his high school sweetheart, Janelle Reed, are back in touch, and she's coming for a visit. The book unfolds over the course of 4 days. Author Lee Smith writes in the blurb, "Who has not dreamed of it? Here's the story of an American generation, the 60s, of all of our lost young loves and a brilliant meditation on the passing and relevance of time." And by the way, Lee Smith is not Walter Bennett. So this is another author writing that. For Ace and Janelle, the relative remoteness of the Outer Banks, where, Bennett says, there's a sense you're disconnected from the continental United States. Could be the perfect place to rekindle a romance, but there's also emotional risk in such a reunion. Why stir up the past and so many memories, both good and bad? On top of that, a hurricane is on the way. Bennett says you're on a strip of land that's hugely vulnerable. The sea on both sides of you, the sky is huge, the wind is stronger. You feel out there. Whether they want to be or not, Ace and Janelle are out there too in old age and whatever's coming toward them. And that could be a hurricane or the vicissitudes of life. Bennett himself is from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Before retiring, he was a trial lawyer, district court judge in Charlotte, and a professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill. His first novel, Leaving Tuscaloosa, was published in 2012. A story of racial conflict in 1960s Alabama, it received the Alabama Authors Award and was a finalist for both the Penn Bellwether Prize for socially engaged fiction and the Crook's Corner Book Prize for debut novels set in the American South. And the Indy recently discussed The Last First Kiss with Bennett while he was staying at his vacation home in Bozeman, Montana. And the remainder of this article is told in a question-answer format. How did the title of the new book come to you? It was after I'd gotten into the book and realized what the story was going to be about, the passage of time, recapturing dreams of youth, or the impossibility of that. This is Ace and Janelle's last chance to create the sensation that they had when they were in their youth and fell in love. I guess it's also the last chance for a first kiss. Not absolutely the last chance, but statistically it probably is. My wife, Betsy, warned me that the title sounds too much like the title of a traditional romance novel. Perhaps, but once I got that title in my head, nothing else seemed to work as well. I got the impression at the beginning of The Last First Kiss that Ace was stuck. Yes, that's exactly the word I would use, and I think he would have stayed stuck if something hadn't happened. This woman comes into his life who clearly was very bright and two steps ahead of him when they were younger, and to my mind still is, and stirs things up. I think relationships do have a way of shaking up a person. I think in part this book is saying it's a good thing to be shook up. Yes, I think so. I think it's harder to do that when you're older. I'll be 78 in a few days. There's something that doesn't want to be shook up anymore. Let's just put the landing gear down and coast on in now. Ace and Janelle are desperate in a way that they don't know. They are both fraught with a great deal of sadness and feelings of loss. The Last First Kiss is, in part, about memory and how faulty it is. I can imagine that the issue of faulty memory has been on your mind your whole career as a lawyer and judge. It has. Not only memory in the sense of going back and trying to understand recaptured memories that you cherish or fear, but what we do with memories. Along those lines, Ace and Janelle are struggling with the past, trying to make sense of it. Why is it important for them to know why their relationship from 60 years ago ended? I think it's important for Ace and his understanding of himself to know that his own ideas of why it might have ended are not correct. And that there's another version, which involves her life, interests and wants and needs and so forth, that he was not aware of at the time. That's part of a universal problem of youth that persists to old age, not really seeing what's going on with other people. And the final question, you transitioned from lawyer and judge to fiction writer. Was that freeing for you personally and creatively? I never thought of it being in terms of being freeing. I guess it was. It was a very tough process because I had learned to think in one way as a lawyer, which is very linear progression, usually. If you're a lawyer, you're trying to make a story fit a preconceived version that you want the judge or jury to see. I'm talking about trial lawyers. It's almost a deductive process, a narrowing process to get it into focus. If you're a judge, you're trying to make all that very clear, take different versions and clarify it into a story that you can accept or go with. Frequently, you don't really believe or know what to believe. But with fiction, you're going in the opposite direction to find truth. You're opening yourself to everything that you can, and you let the creative mind come up with all those options and ideas. And again, that's by Walter Bennett interview on his book, The Last First Kiss. And round out our issue as best I can from Food and Drink, Sarah Edwards writes about well-balanced. Sommelier Paolo Depano leaves her post at Farrington Village to open a principled new wine shop. Just the first paragraph. When she opens her new wine shop, Acid Plus Rocks. Paolo Depano has a set of firm but friendly principles at the ready. Acid, not alcohol. Families, not factories. Drink, not get drunk. After 15 years in the beverage industry, Depano, a stylish star in the wine world with a degree from the Culinary Institute of America and a lengthy list of accolades under her belt, has come to know her values well. She says of her future shop mantras, "No, it's not political at all. I know there will be a lot of like, oh, this sounds political. I just call it basic human kindness." At the end of August, Paolo Depano sent out an email to a close group of customers announcing she was leaving and her beverage director at Farrington Village. And Acid Plus Rocks is at 712 Market Street in the former Medlin Davis dry cleaner space. And I guess that's in Chapel Hill. And unfortunately, the only other article I have, can even read the opening paragraph, another spiritual article, Kindred Spirits, Raleigh's Young Hearts Distilling, embraces traditional spirits and modern cuisine. Until recently, that space at 225 South Wilmington Street has played host to craft beer destinations, with Young Hearts Distilling, opened in late August by the team behind Trophy Brewing Company, a new beverage company is on display. Craft distilled spirits alongside a menu of refined new American cuisine. And the co-owner Chris Power says, "When we got into brewing, we thought distilling was the next step for us. We were thinking about how we could continue to grow and about what gets us the most excited. It was about being experimental and creative." Well, you may be able to hear our theme music still being played by the Choco Speedo Swirly Whirly Frozen Confectionery LLC truck parked outside. We were able to get them to stick around to play our closing theme by simply ordering 75 more yummies from them, which we have to now go out and eat. Can do. John Federson from Indie Week saying, if you come around next week, you'll hear the next issue. If you want to hear this again, we're on the podcast section at NC Reading Service.org. So long, folks. Yummy.